You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. California Assembly Speaker Anthony Rendon, a Democrat, has blocked the Medicare for All single-payer universal health care bill. The bill passed the California Senate. The California Nurses Association, National Nurses United, and Senator Bernie Sanders are calling on Speaker Rendon to stop blocking the health care bill. Sanders says he's extremely disappointed that California Assembly Speaker Rendon is not allowing that Medicare for All bill to come to a vote. The California Nurses Association is condemning Rendon's action, quote, to destroy the aspirations of millions of Californians for guaranteed health care without being bankrupted or forced to skip needed care, end quote. The Nurses Union says that Rendon acted in the interests of the profiteering insurance companies, abandoning people already threatened by Congress and the Trump administration's actions on health care. Deborah Berger, co-president of the California Nurses Association, says thousands of Californians have been in motion for guaranteed health care, and they are not finished. The AFL-CIO is launching an ad campaign against the Republican health care bill nationally that kicks millions off coverage so the wealthy can get tax breaks. Here's an audio excerpt from an AFL-CIO video criticizing the GOP bill.
The law will make health care more expensive for everyday Americans and transfer the money meant for us to the richest 1%. Boiled down, it's just a tax break for CEOs and corporations. Why should hardworking Americans give up the freedom that comes from having affordable health care so the rich can get richer? Our children and aging parents are more important than the wealthiest 1%.
Jobs allegedly saved by Trump have a short shelf life. 700 workers at the carrier company in Indianapolis will begin getting layoff notices in July. Trump claimed to have saved 1,100 jobs at Carrier, but United Steelworkers Local 1999 says he never saved that many. Carrier is shifting production from Indianapolis to Mexico. The United Auto Workers say that a U.S. Supreme Court decision not to take a case regarding union organizing at Macy's should persuade VW to drop its anti-union court case. The NLRB has ordered Volkswagen to negotiate with UAW Local 42 in Chattanooga, Tennessee, a small skilled trades unit of the union. VW refuses, maintaining that if a union election is held, all the workers in the plant should be included in the bargaining unit and in the election. It's essentially the same argument Macy's made when the Supreme Court decided not to take the case. UAW Secretary Treasurer Gary Castile says the UAW is renewing its call for VW to drop its, quote, frivolous appeal and meet employees at the bargaining table in Chattanooga, end quote. WIN is made possible in part by the OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.
You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Don Guerra.
And I'm Leah Carter. This is the Daily Local News for Tuesday, June 27th, 2017.
And so you just have to take a faith walk in hoping that whatever lies around the corner will not try to harm you just because you're honest with who you are.
Local residents gathered to remember the victims of the Pulse nightclub attack. We'll have more on that event later in the show in today's WFHB Community Report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, Everyday People, a weekly segment aimed at improving the lives of older adults and people with disabilities in Monroe County. But first, these local headlines.
Concern about the way Monroe County community schools collect unpaid lunch debts is prompting some community members to voice their discomfort at tonight's school board meeting. The federal school lunch program now requires school districts to formalize in writing the policies they have to collect unpaid lunch debt from students whose account balances are negative. Policy 8500 is MCCSC's formalization of the practice the schools were already using for some time. The policy establishes in writing that students on full-price lunch plans who run out of money may charge up to the value of three meals after their balance falls to zero. A student who has exceeded three charges and cannot pay either the outstanding balance or for a meal itself, however, will not be able to eat the food on their tray. Instead, any food on their tray will be taken off, exchanged for either a peanut butter or cheese sandwich, a half cup of fruit, and a pint of milk. Some community members have called the practice lunch shaming and believe the experience can be traumatic for children. Sue Wanzer is a member of the MCCSC school board.
I mean, it's great that kids can get three lunches in debt. You know, once they have no money in their account, they can go ahead and charge three lunches. That's great. But after that, the fact that they will go through a line, take a meal, and be told that they can't have that meal, and the unwrapped portion of a hot meal is taken and thrown away, is the first thing that is really upsetting to me. And we're doing that for only one reason, and that's to put the kid in the middle between the school and the parents, to force the parents to pay.
Bloomington Township trustee Lillian Henniger says the practice may also shame some working parents. Henniger says that stigma surrounding the issue may cause some people to believe that parents who don't pay their children's lunch bills are doing a poor job as parents, instead of considering the struggles of low-income parents.
I remember getting bills and, like, I can't pay that right now. This is too, I don't, you know, it's like I've got to pay rent. I've got to pay the utilities. I've got to, you know, put food on the table. And so it wasn't because, I take exception when people think that parents are being lazy, that they are freeloading, they are choosing to spend their money on luxury items, whatever that means, or drugs, when in fact it's because we're busy, have too much on our plate as it is, working jobs, trying to take care of everything, and then don't have enough money even to cover our basic bills, and then to get handed these bills. It just seems totally insensitive and not understanding what parents are going through.
Both Wanzer and Henniger say the issue really lies between the parents and the school systems. Children, they say, shouldn't be brought into the middle of the situation. Wanzer says she'd like to see the school board try a new policy, one that exempts children from the debt collecting process entirely.
Let's just try it. Let's try letting every kid get the meal that they want, and if families are in debt, we'll deal with the family. We'll either try to work out something for them to pay the debt. We'll take money out of our budget to pay the debt. We'll use donations to pay the debt. I just think it'd be interesting to try this for a year and see what would happen.
The school board meeting will be held at 6 p.m. this evening at MCCSC's Administration Center. The foundation of MCCSC takes financial donations that can be applied to outstanding lunch debts. For more information or to donate, visit mccsfoundation.org.
A statewide survey by the Indiana Institute on Disability and Community finds that teachers have increasingly favorable views toward educator evaluation, while superintendents have grown less fond of them. The 2016 survey examines how attitudes toward evaluations changed during the past few years. 2011 saw the introduction of Indiana's Senate Enrollment Act 1, a law requiring teachers to be evaluated annually. Educators then get placed in one of the four categories: highly effective, effective, improvement necessary, and ineffective. The president of the Monroe County Teachers Association, Paul Farmer, says the system has some issues that need to be worked out, one of them being the role of test scores in evaluations.
There are some research out there that has shown that because you're using test scores from an evaluative standpoint, the test scores themselves do not produce better teaching or better learning for students. The big thing about the test scores, I think what it has done for teachers, unfortunately, is a stress standpoint. You know, teachers, we know test taking, like the one that we, you know, what we used to call the old I-step, now it's going to be something different. Just because kids score well or not so well on those is not going to be an indicator that the student is not learning the things that they should be learning.
Farmer went on to say the evaluations aren't entirely fair, and some teachers are suffering.
There are actually financial consequences to the evaluation as well. So if a teacher happens to fall within either the needs improvement category or the ineffective category, by statute, that teacher is not allowed to have any kind of a pay increase whatsoever, any of the teacher performance grant money, or what they call the appreciation grant money now, starting this year. So the consequences of an evaluation, well, skyrocketed.
But the results of the 2016 survey show that teachers are becoming comfortable with the nature of the evaluations. Principals' attitudes remain essentially the same, but superintendents' views decreased so much that principals are now the group with the most favorable opinion of educator evaluation requirements.
In its meeting last night, members of the Bloomington Plan Commission almost unanimously approved adoption of the most recent draft of the city's new comprehensive plan. The lone dissenting vote came from Commission member Brad Whistler, who took issue with amendments to policy statements meant to limit student-oriented development. Whistler said, though he understood the concerns behind the amendments, he wished the commission could have found a better way to handle them than targeting a specific group of people.
But I don't think that the way we should be approaching this, especially in terms of a document that is going to be setting the tone for our community and sending the message to our community about how we want to see our community develop, I just don't think it's appropriate to have language that targets one particular group of our residents and says, well, we want them to live in one part of town versus another. We don't do that with any other group in our community. I think we would be ashamed if we did.
Whistler was absent last week when the Plan Commission discussed and approved the two amendments brought by Commission Chair Joe Hoffman. The First Amendment states the city will strongly discourage new student-oriented housing developments downtown until a balance of different housing types is achieved. The second redirects new student-oriented housing developments toward what Hoffman termed more appropriate locations near the IU campus. Whistler sees segregation in the city's built environment as a critical issue, one he plans to work closely with the city council on. The next stop for the draft COM plan is the city council, which can reject, amend, or adopt it. Plan Commission member Isabel Piedmont-Smith serves on the City Council. Piedmont-Smith said the current draft comp plan is, quote, 10 times better than the draft the Commission reviewed last summer, unquote. But she said to expect more amendments from City Council members.
I think it's really valuable to get different points of view, and I think we'll see that on the City Council as well. We may all be Democrats, but we all have different perspectives on things, and I think that'll help hone the document even more.
Piedmont Smith was one of several council members who thanked the community for its input and encouraged continued participation. The city began working on an updated master plan for the city's future growth in 2011. A working draft was made available for public input last summer.
This is just a planning document, very important, but it doesn't have the force of law. So the next step is the updated Unified Development Ordinance, and so I encourage people to stay involved and help us as we actually draft the laws to implement the vision.
The City Council does not, by law, have a deadline for completing its review of the comprehensive plan.
More than 750,000 of the adults currently living in Indiana dropped out of college before earning degrees. So says the Indiana Business Journal in an article about Indiana's push to help them finish their education. Through a You Can Go Back initiative launched last year, more than 9,000 people contacted by this state have reportedly re-enrolled in college. That's 4.5% of the Indiana Commission for Higher Education's goal of re-enrolling 200,000 people by 2020. The effort is primarily supported by a $7.5 million annual grant, which funded more than 5,360 scholarships last year. Lawmakers have also approved an additional $2 million annually for a new workforce-ready grant program. Currently, 41% of Hoosier adults have college degrees. The Commission for Higher Education has a mission to increase that number to 60%.
The Indiana Department of Homeland Security is now accepting applications for the Secure Indiana Scholarship, that provides 20 students up to $2,000 to pursue a career in public safety. A grade point minimum of 2.8 on a 4.0 scale is required, along with current service as a volunteer in a public safety organization. The application deadline is August 1st. More information is available at in.gov/DHS/foundation scholarship. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Leah Carter.
And I'm Don Guerra. The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
This past weekend, local residents gathered to recognize the one-year anniversary of the Pulse nightclub attack. WFHB correspondent Arjun Balasundaram was on hand for the event, and he brings us this story for today's WFHB Community Report.
To honor the 49 victims who died in the Orlando Pulse shooting on June 12, 2016, Bloomington Pride organized a community picnic at the Woodlawn Shelter in Bryan Park on Sunday. Jane Cummings, the chair of Bloomington Pride, kicked off the afternoon by sharing a few words about the shooting massacre that happened last June.
A year ago, 378 days to be exact, we lost 49 members of our LGBTQ plus community in what is the deadliest mass shooter experienced by a single shooter and the largest incidents of violence against our family in U.S. history. Most of the victims and survivors were people of color and Latinx folks. And these are people who rarely feel like they have a home in our community. They don't feel like their voices are heard. They feel often silenced. But they also face the largest incidences of racism, of homelessness, issues dealing with immigration, police violence and incarceration. And communities like ours, generally in Bloomington and beyond, we don't hear from them.
Food for the event was donated by Kroger's as well as community members attending the event. Willy Palomo, a Latino poet from the LGBT community, broke down a few times while talking about the victims of the Orlando shooting and the difficulties faced by their community in opening up about their identity.
It has taken me much longer than many of the people here to learn how to stop punishing and rejecting my queer self, how to love and celebrate her. While the violence of the Pulse massacre and of patriarchy and machismo and of conservative Christianity has kept me from fully embracing myself, it is spaces like these that have given me the permission to love myself. For the past year especially, I've spent a lot of time speaking in front of audiences. I have felt wholly unqualified to do so, and nowhere has that been more true than here right now. It is by watching the activism of queer youth, like the youth in prison, the poetry and art of my queer friends and heroes, that I've learned how to slowly strip away the baggage of my Mormon upbringing and how to love my body without being wrapped with guilt. A little bit about Mormonism for people who don't know anything about it. So straight people feel sexually oppressed in the Mormon religion. And I didn't know I was queer when I was growing up and was already suicidal every day because of it. It was my only Latino community in Utah, which made leaving the church a lot more complicated. But I'm really grateful I was able to move out of it. And it was just with the support of many of my queer friends that I was able to do that.
Palomo also read the first poem he wrote describing his father's feeling when they first crossed the border from El Salvador.
Mijo, I know you have seen the night as an excuse to hold your body like a bottle and drink yourself to sleep in the morning. The sun will rise bright as an infant fear in your throat. You will not die as much as you wish for it. You will get lucky. Friends will envy you with empty hands, and whether or not you deserve it, you will lose people you loved wrong, and I know what that's like. To love until you lose hope in yourself, no one wants to talk about it. how at the border they offered us clean criminal records, our first ride on an airplane if we went back to El Salvador. It's so hard to leave, and of course your deal, he went back. For a girl, said he would try again the right way, but there is never a right way to leave. We would have never left if there was a choice to make, but sometimes we leave to survive. Leaving is what makes us, and you will become a man in all the wrong ways, which is to say, there is no right way. After your deal left, Border Patrol let me go into the blinding street with nothing, no, not even a bus route, always an orphan without a family to call a motherland, only an address to your tías and my eighth grade dropout's command of survival. Mijo, I made it. There is no need for a map. If fear is your new face, learn to kiss him, eyes open, without a border between your lips.
Patricio Batani, the show director of the Backdoor Bar in Bloomington, read out the names of the 49 victims as they lit a candle for each one of them. Photos of the deceased, along with their names, were placed below the lighted candles. Batani also briefly explained about the One Pulse Foundation.
The One Pulse Foundation was started by the owner of Pulse Orlando to provide money to begin the memorial, to maintain the memorial and ultimately have a museum, but also to provide scholarships in the names of the victims and also support the families of the victims of the Pulse shooting. And that is what the donation will go to today as well.
Following that, a minute of silence was observed for the victims of that fateful day. Julius Lee, a member of the LGBT community, shared his first reactions after finding out about the shooting last year.
I was in tears because the Pulse nightclub is a place of gathering where people can celebrate who they are, celebrate with friends, and love each other as friends. And for that to happen, I was in tears.
On the threat facing their community, Lee said,
"Well, I can only speak for myself. I can't speak for the community. And you never know what lies around the corner. Not that you should live your life in fear, but sometimes you cannot live your life in peace. And so you just have to take a faith walk in hoping that whatever lies around the corner will not try to harm you just because you're honest with who you are."
Renee Miller, attending the event with her wife, Yana Honeycutt, shared her message to those targeting certain sections of the community, including the LGBT community.
Ask yourself why you're targeting someone else and where that comes from, because that can't come from a place of love. And just don't do it.
Sister Sonata Innocent from the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, who has in the past lived in Orlando for 13 years, encouraged people at the picnic to write a supportive message for the families of the victims on her pink veil.
And so today I'm here with a veil of love. Two sisters have a traditional ritual and ceremony where people will write their shame on a veil and then we'll go burn it, and so in a ceremony. And so what I'm doing today is I'm having a pink veil instead, and encouraging folks to write messages of love. And we'll send that to the sisters. There are sisters in Orlando, and so we'll send it to them, and they can choose to utilize it in whatever ritual or ceremony they'd like.
Reporting for WFHB, I am Arjun Balasundaram.
Support for WFHB and the Daily Local News comes from Smithville Fiber, a local provider of internet, voice, and TV service, now also offering home automation and security systems for homes and offices throughout South Central Indiana. More information on Smithville's home automation service is available at smithvillesecurity.com.
Coming up next, WFHB's weekly community resources segment, Everyday People.
Don't mess around. Cause I got eyes all over town.
Welcome to Everyday People, improving the lives of older adults and people with disabilities in Monroe County.
Everyday resources for everyday people. Connecting our community by sharing resources you need, want, and probably don't know about.
Hi, we're here today with the lovely Lehua Aplaka from Area 10 Agency on Aging. Lehua, can you talk to us just generally about your role within the agency?
I'm the Nutrition Program Manager, and so I directly oversee our hot meal program, and then my assistant actually directly oversees our mobile food pantry. Now, for the mobile food pantry, we deliver groceries to about 200-plus seniors once a month, and these are homebound seniors who don't have access to reliable transportation and therefore probably don't have reliable access to food. And then I oversee, kind of like a Meals on Wheels program, seniors are provided daily meals so that they can be sure that they're getting the nutrition they need. Many of them are also homebound and then also face, you know, as they get older, they might have difficulty with balance, so they're not able to stay upright safely for the length of time needed to cook. They too might not be able to shop and get all of the food they need to have nutritious meals, and so we bring those in for them.
So how does one qualify for either one of these programs? And is it the same qualification for both?
Not necessarily, just because with the meal programs, we have different funding streams that Area 10 receives from various organizations, the government included, to help pay for the meals so that the seniors don't necessarily have to take on those costs themselves. And so the best way for someone to try and qualify for the meal program would be to call into Area 10, speak with their resource center, and they have an intake questionnaire that helps them assess their needs, see what they might qualify for, and then we'll get them started as soon as we can. With the mobile food pantry, it's just age 60 plus. As I said, not reliable access to transportation.
Not only are you providing nutritious meals to seniors, but you're fulfilling an important element as far as social isolation. A lot of the times when seniors aren't able to get out in their homebound, Area 10 staff and volunteers are some of the few people they might see.
You know, some of these people have been on their delivery routes for such time that they develop amazing relationships with the delivery drivers. We stress that with the drivers as well. It's like, if you guys notice something, you know, please let us know. And I guess I should also say, too, with the meal program, it's not just home-delivered meals, but at different locations, we actually have congregate sites where seniors can come together and share a meal free of charge. They don't have to pay for it, but it's a chance for them to socialize and also keep that side of their lives as vibrant as possible.
I've actually had the pleasure of visiting some of those meal sites. I've delivered the hot meals, and I now do a grocery route for homebound seniors. We do two routes, actually. Mm-hmm. Something else, too, that you and I have kind of discovered a little bit more of is the pet food donations. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
A lot of our seniors, they have their companions. These are their animals that many times become their entire family, you know, with circumstances that just happen with aging. And so we are so grateful. Petco is one of the big sources for us. They donate where they have a bin set up where people can donate food because, you know, many of us have heard about food insecurity for seniors. Well, they will make the choice between maybe buying food or paying for their medicine. You know what I mean? That's a choice they have to face. Same thing with their pets. And many of them will buy food for their pets before they will buy food for themselves because this is their whole life.
Or, yeah, they're sharing their food with their pets directly.
Which then directly affects the amount of nutrition they're receiving. Mm-hmm. As I said, the best first stop when you call Area 10 is the Resource Center. So if you just call 812-876-3383 and ask the receptionist who will answer to speak to the resource center and let her know that you are interested in perhaps getting some help with nutrition. She'll refer you over to the ladies in the resource center who are all awesome, and they'll get you started on the path to getting what you need.
Lehua, thank you so much for being here and for the awesome work that you're doing with Area 10.
Thank you so much. Thanks for joining us on Everyday People.
Tune in next week for more information and resources that connect everyday people to everyday resources. For WFHB, I'm Courtney Stewart.
And I'm Stacey Goffinet.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Lindsay Jones, Cole Stinson, and Kathy Norton, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Arjun Balasundaram.
Everyday People is produced by Courtney Stewart and Stacey Goffney. Our engineer is Megan Wade. Our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Joe Crawford. For WFHB, I'm Leah Carter.
And I'm Don Guerra. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast as well as all other WFHB news programming online at WFHB.org.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@WFHB.org.
Stay tuned for Interchange, Bloomington Community Radio's longest-running public affairs program, coming up next on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.